This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, as we look back on the first half of a season that has certainly been one to remember. The turnover of managers seems to get ever faster, with a third of the EFL's 72 clubs having made a change since we kicked off. At the top of all three divisions, a few clubs have already given themselves a decent cushion. Meanwhile, for the first time ever, we've had a brief winter break to allow for the 2022 Qatar World Cup. So let's take stock of where we are and bring you up to date with some of the stories you may have missed over the past 5 months, with the very best of the guests so far this season on the official EFL podcast. So just to prove how quickly managerial appointments can change in the world of modern day football, let's welcome Rob Edwards. Rob led Forest Green Rovers to promotion from Sky Bet League 2 last season, and in the process caught the eye of many potential new suitors, including Watford, who installed him as their new head coach in the summer. But after just 10 league games, he was dismissed, like so many others before him. A couple of months later, and he'd taken over from Nathan Jones at Watford's local rivals Luton Town, where he's relishing his new opportunity. But that doesn't mean we can't rewind the clock and enjoy his Elton John story from his early days at Vicarage Road.
Now listen, final questions are regarding a certain well-known figurehead who supports Watford. I've had this conversation with quite a few managers over the years, as you can fully imagine. And where were you when you first got your call from Elton? Do you get like a little message, Elton's going to be in touch? Or are you literally sitting in your conservatory and the phone goes and you go, I don't recognize this mobile number, and you answer it and Elton's on the far end? How does the protocol work with
it? The first time we spoke was he called the chairman's phone. So I spoke when I was down at the club, and I spoke to him on the chairman's phone. So I had a few minutes with him, and he was really, really positive. He was very, very supportive.
Wait a second. You're in the chairman's office and the chairman's phone goes and the chairman goes.
He came running in, Clem. So I was doing a bit of media work. I think, you know, it'd been a couple of days in, so very, very early, and just down there to do a little bit of media stuff with our Prab website and things like that. And then Scott, the chairman, came running in and went, it's Sir Elton. So just drop everything and hello. And it was surreal. He was really supportive and very, very positive, which was lovely to hear, because obviously, you know, if he's on board, then that helps a lot.
And Rob, he knows his
very
stuff.
Knowledgeable.
He knew what you'd achieved last season. He knew what you'd done before and stuff.
I think, obviously that he would have done his research. And he said, you know, he said, and this is like, you know, he said, oh, it feels like, you know, when Graham Taylor took over and, you know, young managers, you know, won League Two and all that. And so, listen, he was really positive and it was great. But then the really surreal one was when we stopped his concert on the Sunday about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I went with my wife and, we got to meet him, so went to see him before the show, and wow. and had had 10 minutes with him. He was asking about all the players again, really knowledgeable, and then he even gave me and Kerry a shout out before one of the songs. And
no,
it was unbelievable. It was an amazing night. And but what about that night as well? His concert was brilliant, but it was a lovely evening. We had a lot of nice weather lately, haven't we? And everyone was there. The stadium was filled with yellow shirts, and it made me realise, look, they're here to see Elton John, I know that, but you know, there's a lot of fans here. This is a big club, and sort of really brought it home that night as well.
Good Lord. You went right into Sir Elton's inner sanctum, his dressing roomy area, before he went on stage. I've heard these tales before where he's quite relaxed before he goes on.
Oh, he's really relaxed.
Yeah?
He was really relaxed, just chilling, chatting to us, and then I'm gonna have to get ready now. And like, literally 15 minutes later, he's walking up the steps and bang on the piano, and off he goes. It was amazing, and he was brilliant on the night as well.
I'll tell you what, has Kerry got a birthday coming up, or have you got a wedding anniversary or anything like that? Because I'd be passing this off as a gift, mate. I'd be pulling, you know, when she goes, oh, you haven't got me an anniversary present. I'd be going, what do you mean I didn't get you an anniversary present? You met Sir Elton John. You've got to play all That's the it. Cards with that.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. So yeah, that was great. That was great.
Rob, we shall follow your progress with interest. Keep up your what was it Emmanuel Dennis called it? Young man vibes. Keep them up, mate, while you can.
Yeah, well, thank you. Cheers, Clem.
Great to talk to you. Good luck, mate.
And you. Take care.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
As with so many key moments in world history, we all remember where we were when we first got the call from Sir Elton, don't we? From Rocketman to Reading now and the Ince family. The man in charge is Dad Paul, whose son Tom is also with him. And while exiled in the sunny south, the two of them are sharing a flat together. It's therefore a case of like father, like son on a Saturday afternoon. And the theme continues post-match, where the pair of them take it in turns with the cooking and the washing up. But domestic bliss aside, we thought you might like to hear the story of Shane Long returning to Reading and the surprised look on the face of another Tom. Some people will look at you bringing in Joe Lumley on loan, Sam Hutch, Jeff Kendrick's come in, hasn't he? Shane Long caught the eye. I mean, he made his first start 11 years after his last start last weekend. I wondered how this went down with Tom McIntyre, because do you know Tom McIntyre used to be a season ticket holder and watched Shane the first time around? I mean, I don't know how that makes Shane feel, but I also wondered whether there was a bit of star worship going on when he wandered into training for the first time.
Well, you know what it was? I think when Shane Long first did his medical, he came into the physio room. And Tom Mack was next to me on the physio bed, and I promise you now, he must have stared at him and looked at him up and down for a good 5-10 minutes, and all the lads were like, "You're right, Tom Mack." He was like, "This is my hero. Like, I had him on my wall and everything." So it was a little bit surreal, because obviously we didn't know. Obviously we know what Longy's, you know, his affiliation with Reading, but Tom Mack was like starstruck. I was thinking, "Wow, Tom." So yeah, it's a little bit surreal for him, but it's great to see, you know, a young lad playing with his hero as such. So, it was a really nice reunion.
Are you a sort of, you obviously been around the Championship a long time. Do you kind of study all the different contenders? Are you that kind of guy, start of the season, you look at who the runners and riders are, who you're likely to be coming up against, or do you tend to do it in blocks over the course of a season?
No, I think as players, you always look out for the certain fixtures, sometimes former clubs, sometimes teams who have come down from the Premier League. You got big clubs in there like Sunderland and Wigan now, obviously never played at Stadium Light, so that's obviously a nice thing to look forward to. But I think, you know, as players, you just sort of get on with it. The games come that thick and fast, you're just trying to accumulate as many points as possible. And this is a very strange league, you know, it is, you know, every week you can't guarantee who's going to beat who. So whereas some fixtures may look like a given, the Championship always springs surprises on you.
Your old man has just got home from work. I'll level with people listening. We're doing this. We're doing this late afternoon on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
Who's cooking dinner tonight? First of all, what's the plan for dinner tonight? Do we know?
I think we're going out for dinner tonight. I think. I think my dad's treating me tonight. So
is he? Do you flip flop on that? You get it one time, he gets it the other.
It depends where we're going, you see. Sometimes, you know, if we're going for McDonald's, then it's on me. If not, then it's definitely him.
That's good strategic thinking, Tom. Listen, I don't want to impinge on family time together. And also, your dad was having the international door slamming tournament in the background just a second ago.
Yeah.
He likes to have a little door slam, does he?
Yeah.
Give him our best. Lovely to talk to you, Tom. Keep up the great work.
Take care.
The life of a goalkeeper is an unusual one, where your own personal fortunes can often be dictated by the misfortunes of another, as Norwich City's Tim Krul explained when we spoke to him back in September. You know, I love a chat about goalkeeping, and I wondered how, you know, when you first went to Newcastle, obviously you were trying to break through and try and unseat the mighty Shea Given and Steve Harper. Now you've got a youngster with huge ties to the club nibbling at your toes. How do you take that as a positive and not get freaked out by it and think, oh, somebody's coming up behind me, but actually take it as a positive to get better and better, to keep them at bay?
I've always played better with competition behind me. you know, and I think it's the level you train at every day. Also, Mickey McGoffin, who was part of the goalkeeping union here, and with the quality we're showing every day, gets me ready for the weekend. And you're right. When I was 18, 19, I wanted to kick Shay Given out of the team and Steve Harper. I was telling the gaffer that I was ready to surpass them all. And I'm the guy now who's getting hunted. So, yeah, lucky enough, I've got the experience to deal with that. Obviously, Ralf Farman a couple of years ago came in, big German, played Champions League. And that was a big challenge to keep him out. And yeah, now we've got obviously Angus Gunn and Mickey. We're all fighting for the number one spot. And I think the good thing is, it obviously helps when you're winning. So then the gaffer's is more happy with the team who's playing. That's, let me put it that way. But yeah, it keeps me on my toes, and I think that's the best way.
Yeah, it's such a lovely blend, isn't it? Because I guess usually your mates are you with rival goalkeepers within the squad?
Most of them.
Most. Oh, okay, I won't push you on that, mate. I won't push you on that.
No, at this club, definitely, I'm lucky. But yeah, there's sometimes also, if you go to the national team or whatever, you're not always mates, but you have to work with each other. But yeah, I've had goalkeepers who on purposely put the ball in the top corner or give you a bad service. It definitely goes on these kind of games.
Yeah, because obviously the fortunes of, say, the number two do directly relate to the misfortunes of the number one, which is why it's such an intriguing proposition to be able to watch a training session, as I've been lucky enough to do at lots of clubs. And I've chatted to you and Mickey certainly before about this situation. It's just one of those intriguing love-hate relationships, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've been number two as well, you know, behind goalkeepers. I was at Brighton and I was the same, you know. It's a weird feeling because you sit on the bench and you don't really want your number one goalkeeper to do so well, you know, but you want your team to win. So it's a really difficult place to be. So I always hoped it was going to be 5-4 every week, and then with four mistakes off the number one. So I get it.
I love it. Tell me something. How old are you now, Tim, please, if you don't mind me asking?
34.
You know, obviously goalkeepers can play a lot longer than the outfield positions, but I wondered how age does affect a goalkeeper. Do you have to look for slightly better techniques of landing, or do you have to work extra hard at your stretching and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think, to be fair, the support now compared to 10 years ago is incredible. I mean, I've got a Pilates session. I've got obviously all the injury prevention in the gym. You've got coaches for everything nowadays. Nutrition is obviously really important. So yeah, touch wood, I've been quite lucky with the support here who keeps me going. And I feel better than I've ever felt, to be honest. I think more the fact that I'm probably more professional now than I was when I was 21. So I've still got a few years in me.
This is the official EFL podcast.
We certainly think Tim has got a good few years in him as well before the potential move into coaching or management, which is exactly what our next guest has done. He'd formed a formidable partnership with close friend Ryan Lowe at Plymouth Argyle. And when Ryan took over at Preston North End and returned to his roots in the Northwest, most people expected his trusty assistant, Stephen Schumacher, to go with him. However, he could see a real opportunity to continue the good work that Ryan and he had begun in the Southwest to shape the club in his own image. And that's exactly what he's been doing to great effect. What do you think the mix of a modern day manager is? A manager of your era, first sort of 3, 4, 5 years into the game. What do you think's in there these days, needs to be in there?
I think the majority of the young coaches, speaking for myself, you've got to be incredibly hard work, and then you've got to have a passion for it, because takes up a lot of time. Obviously, your family is the most important thing, but my family and my kids know that I'm always preparing for games, or I'm analysing games that we've just watched. So you've got to have a passion about it, and you've got to be dedicated to put the hours in.
Hold on, Stephen. Hold on a second. So paint a picture for me. Are the family with you in the Southwest? They are with you? Because that would be a hell of a struggle for you, wouldn't it, if they was up in the Northwest?
Yeah, and that was one of the... when I was playing at Stevenage, Clem, I lived for 12 months without away from. I had two really young, the kids were really young at the time. And I lived for a year away from my missus and the kids, and it was a struggle. And in the second season, we lived together. So we said, wherever we go from now on, we'll just all go as a package, because it was too far to commute backwards and forwards to Liverpool in the northwest. So when we got offered this job down in Plymouth, obviously I knew where it was geographically, and then I knew that it can't commute backwards and forwards, especially with the hours that a number two has got to do and watching the games and stuff. It just wouldn't have worked. And my kids were 5 and 8 at the time, so relocating them from the northwest down to the southwest was okay, because they went straight into primary schools, and within 2 days I had best friends. So they were cool and they got settled in. My wife met friends down here. It's a lovely part of the world, but people are friendly. They're very similar to where we're from up in the northwest. So she settled in great. And it's a gorgeous part of the world to bring your family up. So really lucky with that it all worked out. And I think it was, you know, made that decision easier then when I was offered the job. Do you want to stay? We were all here. We were all settled. And leaving Ryan was a big decision. But it's one I felt I was ready for. And as I say, my wife and the kids were happy down here. Didn't feel any rush to get home. And so we went for it.
Yeah. And paint a picture for us at home, because you said you're constantly preparing for a game and stuff. Does that mean you're in the room with them, but sometimes you're not in the room? They're, Dad, can you help me with this bit of homework? Dad, are you going to come and watch Strictly Preview or something? Meanwhile, you're sitting down there. Yeah, I will in a second, but I just want to check how this Aki Stanley centre-half is on his left side.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You are there all the time, but sometimes you're not there. Your brain is elsewhere. And I'm guessing all the other young managers that we've just been speaking about, that's another one of the traits. Like, we can never switch off. Like, I think the older you get, the more experience you get. Like, I speak to Nigel Pearson, I speak to the other managers who've been in and around. They've found a way to switch off. But at this moment in time, where I'm still learning and still trying to figure out how to be a head coach and a manager, the game is constantly on my mind. I'm lucky that I've got a young lad. I've got a lad who absolutely loves football. My little boy, Vincent, he's 8. And sometimes he'll come and watch games with me and sit on my knee and watch it while I'm watching the laptop. We watched the game the other day, and within 10 minutes, he said to me, "Dad, this is boring, this game. The ball's always in the air and it's always out of play." He said, "I'm not watching it." So I won't name the team who we watch, but yeah, he gave up after 10 minutes, but I had to slog on through it.
I'll tell you what, there's a lovely story that Robbie Martinez told probably 7 or 8 years ago now, that him and his missus at home have L-shaped sofas and they've got two tellies, and he's got one on one wall with radio headphones, and then Beth's got one on the other wall, I think, and she can watch. So they can sit together, be together, but he's not sitting in a study somewhere and they're not together, but he's also not dictating, better just watch Spanish League 2 just in case there's a player in there that should be on my radar, which I thought was quite a nice way of doing things, you know?
It is nice, but I don't think my wife, Victoria, would put up with that. So I'm quite lucky, Clem. We only live 5 minutes from the stadium, so I can stay and work till whatever hours I need to stay in. I can get all my work done and then come out the office, put my laptop away, come home, do the school run, take the kids to dance class or football training or whatever they've got. And then, before you know it, it's bedtime and back to the grind again the next day. Great.
All those 400 plus games you played, lots of different managers, lots of different characteristics. Who's been a big influence on you?
What, former managers?
Yeah.
I think I've learned sort of something from all of them. I thought I worked under some real good coaches and some young, inexperienced ones, some highly experienced ones. My first one I remember was Colin Todd when I went to Bradford City. And I hadn't heard from him since I left in like 2007, I think I left Bradford City. And he called me the first week that I got the job and just said he wanted to touch base and say good luck and if you need any advice and any help, he was always there on the end of the phone. So I thought that was nice. He was brilliant. He gave us the confidence as a young boy leaving Everton, sort of down a little bit because David Moyes just released me, sort of gave me the confidence to go and play and played 130 games or whatever for Bradford under him and loved it. So it was nice to hear from him. And then one of the other coaches who I really respected and got on really well was Alan Nil. He had us at Bury. He's now Chris Wilder's number two. So again, when I was a number two, could pick the phone up to Nilly and ask him for advice. And and help whenever I needed it. But I think good and bad managers who have worked under throughout my career have sort of tried to take something from all of them. And yet I think even subconsciously they help mould you to what type of coach you're going to be in the future as well. So yeah, I've enjoyed it. I've been quite lucky, really.
Yeah. Are you and Louis quite similar? Because I had the pleasure of watching a training session just before you took over. I don't know if you remember, came out for Football Focus, but I think you were in the thick of it. And Ryan that day was a bit more sort of, you know, what managers do sometimes, stand there with their arms folded and just observe the finer nuances of a session. But you do seem to have very similar sunny personalities. Would that be a reasonable interpretation?
Yeah, I think we're both incredibly positive people. So I think, and again, we love what we do. Our styles are different. So Ryan is probably more extrovert than I am. I'm probably a bit more reserved and think about things a little bit more before I speak. And Ryan's very good. He works a lot off instinct. He's brilliant, like just in a room. And when he gets thrown into a situation, he can adapt. But our styles are different on the coaching pitch. I was, as you say, the one who was in the thick of it and going through the detail. That's the type of personality I was. And Ryan could stand there and watch and observe. But then if he had something to say, more often than not, he'd be blob on with what he needed to do. And that little relationship that we had, it worked. It was good. We had a great partnership, and it was for 4.5 years, whatever we worked together. And we complemented each other. Now, Ryan's gone and got now Mike Marsh, who I know is a real good grass coach and is probably very similar to me, goes through the details. So he's probably continued to do what he's done. And I've brought in Mark Hughes as my number two, as my assistant, who isn't quite, I've got the experience yet of being the grass coach and doing the detail every single day. But his observation, he's only just finished playing. He was, we got him from Bristol Rovers and in January, he just, literally just retired. So him giving information to the players, just dropping in every now and again, this information that he can give is so valuable. So I think whatever way you have your partnership, it's got to sort of complement each other. And me and Ryan certainly did that, yeah.
They certainly did. And it's great to see both of them doing so well at their respective clubs. Some say the grass is always greener, and it's fair to say that it probably is when Luton Town's Henry Lansbury is around, as he eyes up a post-playing career that is perhaps what you'd expect. Well, I can see you've got your branded sweatshirt on with the Grass Gains logo emblazoned across it. And I tell you what, mate, I've done a little bit of research on this myself, and you can expect puns like done some digging, seed of an idea, root of the issue, not a patch, thin on the ground, go over all ground to come up over the course of the rest of this interview. Go on then. What's the story about all of this?
So during lockdown, I had a gardener come in. I won't say who they were or anything, but they did my grass, and I normally like my grass quite short. And I've gone out there and looked at it, and I said, "Mate, this is a bit long." He was like, "Yeah, I'm going to go back over it." I was like, "All right, no problem." 2 minutes later, I've just seen his van pull off. So I'm like, "No way, he just left." So I rang the company up. I said, "Look, don't worry, coming in anymore." And then I was friends with one of the ex-Arsenal groundsmen. And I was like, "Mate, I need a mower." He got me one the next day. And ever since that, I haven't looked back.
So you basically caught the bug. Is there some sort of relaxation in there as well in putting stripes across your lawn? Is that part of the picture?
Well, you could say that. That is probably part of it. But I think the main part is probably getting out of the house, because I have 3 children. So it's a bit of me time outside.
And this has now turned into a business for you?
So, yeah, well, I did start going around cutting friends, family's grass. And I went and bought an old van, put my sign on the side of it, and started going around, put my mowers in, and started going around. I went around to Tom Lockyer's house, who's with us. I went and started his garden. Now he's got the bug. But then I was obviously doing the fertilizer as the main business. So it was like where I was spraying it, putting fertilizer down it. And my wife's very non-toxic kind of, she was like, "You can't keep spraying this on the grass. It's not good for the environment, not good for the kids." So I was like, I spoke to my friend Mark, and I was like, "Mark, is there any like organic fertilizer out there I could put on my lawn?" And he was looking, he was like, "There's not that many that I'd recommend." So I said, come on in, let's go for it. Why don't we make one? And he was like, you're mad. Do you know that? I said, yeah, but like, I can't keep spraying all the weed killer and all that on the grass. I need something. So that's how it's all come about. They're all organic, plant-based, helping the environment.
And Mark does have previous gardening experience. You weren't sort of mixing things up on the kitchen table going, I wonder if this will work.
No, I wish. No, he used to work at Arsenal. So he was at Highbury in the Emirates. And then he left and he's now doing like pitch renovations and gardens and stuff like that.
I can hear you've got building work going on. You obviously like a bit of DIY and stuff going on around the house. Are you quite serious then? Is this a potential post-career looming for you? Are you hoping to grow the organic fertilizer brand?
Yeah, definitely. This is probably one of my main businesses right now. So I will be going full on into this. Well, I'm full on in it now. But probably, hopefully, maybe next year might be the time, but we'll see what happens at the end of the season.
I do need to take you back. I've got a few supplementary questions on things we've already discussed. First of all, Tom Lockyer, did you charge him to do his grass, or was this a favour for a mate?
No, this is a favour. I'm a nice guy. If it's he hasn't got a massive lawn, so it didn't take me too long. But if it's over a certain size, I will start charging time.
Now, listen, is this true or a wind-up? I think it was Carlton Morris that mentioned this. Have you got a little patch of grass that you look after on the training ground?
That's true. So where the change rooms are, we walk out onto it. It's about just under a tennis court size. Bit of grass. So when we first started, they were taking care of it, but not for my standard when I was really into it. And one day, it's a funny story actually, I pulled up in my van a bit earlier before training and got the mower out, had my hood up because it was cold, and I started mowing it, and the groundsman come over and he was like, whoa, what are you doing, mate? I said, I'm here for the groundsman job. I was just going to show you what I could do. And I still had my hood up, so he couldn't really see it was me. He was like, no, you can't do this. You can't do this. I said, no, I want to show you what I can do. Like, had him going a bit. And then I took my hood off. I was like, it's only me, Dickie. Like, come on. And he was laughing. So ever since, he was like, you can look after this now.
So with your van and your mowers and your organic fertilizers, you are actually punting your services to the general public now, not just to friends and family. The whole thing's gone way, way bigger.
Yeah, the whole, everyone. Yeah. We're doing quite well, to be fair. Now, obviously, you know a lot of people and that, and I might try and start something up where I go around the footballers' houses and my ex-players, ex-managers, and have a chat and do the garden.
That is fantastic. And do you play on your name in the local area? I mean, do you think people realise that it's you when they respond to an ad or word of mouth? Or do you think they genuinely haven't got a clue that when you turn up on a Saturday morning, you've scored a worldie the night before on TV?
Well, the funny thing was, I have an Instagram page called The Lawn Lad, and I didn't really put my face on it. And then now I scored, obviously did the celebration. Someone obviously clocked on, and everyone's like, oh, Henry Lowndes was the Lawn Lad. Da, da, da. But I was going around before, like, I was going to go and do some, I did the local pitch for my friends. We play on it, and went over there and helped them out with that. So I'm literally just all about the grass, really.
Wow. And has it changed your perspective on visiting grounds as well? Like when you get off the bus, you go down the tunnel out on the pitch, you're supposed to be getting a feel for what's happening in the stands as the ground fills up, but you're literally marching around the pitch inspecting the grass.
I'm saying to the boys, oh, this grass is lovely, look at this, like, this is unbelievable. Then I'll even have a chat with the groundsman. I'm like, what height are you cutting this at? Like, what are you putting down in it? So I'd rather chat to the groundsman than the team.
And this is all absolutely true. There was no going to granny and grandpa's when you were growing up, or mum and dad didn't used to have green fingers or anything like that. It was just that moment in lockdown.
That time at home and just getting, obviously sorting the house out and then sorting your garden out. And ever since that, it was just boom, full on.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
And you could probably tell from this slight sense of surprise in my voice, there was part of me that still thought that Henry's love of grass was a wind-up. But it would seem that my scepticism was misplaced. Mow the fool me. See what I've done there? October is Black History Month, And it was an opportunity to speak to a legend of the game. They don't come much bigger than QPR's director of football, Sir Les Ferdinand. It is Black History Month, and I think you and I have an affinity on this front, which is I just want to get you on because you're a nice fella and I like talking to you. But inevitably, when this month comes on, we look for black icons to come and talk through some of the trials and tribulations. Is this a conversation that you feel you must continue to have in order to improve representation and do your bit? And certainly somebody like a Luther Blissett or a Hope Powell I've had this conversation with says, yep, we got to keep banging the drum. Or do you find it irksome to be wheeled out in this particular month?
I find it irksome to be wheeled out in this particular month because why are we just talking about it in a particular month? It's a problem that happens throughout the year. We've seen it year in, year out. I was looking at some stats again the other day of, 43% of players in the Premier League are black or Asian identity. In the Championship, it's 30%. 14% of black coaches have all the qualifications to be in the game, yet only 4% are represented. And that doesn't change over the month of October, Black History Month. That goes throughout the year. So, I find it difficult to just have this conversation and be wheeled out in October. And as you say, bang the drum. There's a lot of lip service, a lot of talk done around it. And I keep calling for action. Let's see the action. Let's stop talking about it. Let's see the action that's coming with all the talk, and there doesn't seem to be too much action.
On the other hand, at your club, there does, because again, when I made that trip for Football Focus to see Mick a few weeks ago, there was just a lovely procession of Paul Furlongs and Paul Halls, and obviously Chris Ramsey is there. Just brilliant expertise and heritage of former players, or is this a conscious decision to make all the people that work behind the scenes to make the club a success as diverse as possible?
To be honest with you, Paul Hall, Paul Furlong were already at the club before I joined. Andrew Impey, Chris Ramsey came in under my stewardship, but people talk about diversity at QPR. I've employed more Caucasian people than I have black at QPR, but we keep getting talked about as being a very diverse football club. What we do, we give opportunities to people who are qualified to do the job. We don't look at their colour. When a CV comes through the door, if I said to you, Mr. Barnes was coming for an interview, or Mr. Ince, or Mr. Richards, or Mr. Walker, you wouldn't know what colour they were. I've just mentioned a couple of former black footballers, but if they weren't former black footballers, when I just gave you those CVs coming through the door, you wouldn't know what colour they were. So we try to look at CVs based on whether they have the qualifications to be able to do the job that we're talking about. And then if they match the criteria that we're looking for, then we call them in for an interview without knowing what colour they are.
I don't want to talk about the specific incident, say, last weekend, because there could be police inquiries going on. People could be charged before this podcast is dropped. But utter revulsion, isn't it, when you see some of the reports from last weekend of the abuse of players and a man's skin colour being used as a stick to beat him with?
Well, this is for you. It's revulsion, but it's something I've been used to for the whole time I've been in football. This is not nothing new, Clem. We're just talking about it now. We're talking about it a bit more. This has been going on for as long as I've played the game, as long as I've been in the game. This has been going on. It's only now that people are talking about it being revolting. It's only now that people are talking about it shouldn't be happening. But like I said, language and political correctness are what we're seeing now. But this is something that's, black players have encountered for most of their careers.
This is the official EFL podcast.
As we entered the month of November, our attentions turned to food, and the idea of bulking up for winter is something I normally find quite easy to do. But there are healthier ways to survive this cold spell, as former footballer turned nutritionist and motivational speaker Mark Pugh explained. I'm trying to be really good. I've been up very early today. And actually, let's level to the listeners of the Officially EFL podcast. We are, what, 11:30 in the morning we're recording this. I got up about 7:15. Did a little bit of mindfulness. I used the Headspace app. Did some calf stretches, little bit of a band over the top just to get the back muscles working, a few sit-ups and things. And then I allowed myself a Marmite crumpet at maybe about 8:15. But as we head towards lunchtime, I thought, I'm not going to get through this chat slavering over some of the food you're going to tell me about without. So I had another crumpet, this time with a bit of Marmite and then a thin sliver of peanut butter on top. Bearing in mind I've been up for 6.5 hours, is that reasonable or have I already overeaten?
No, that's not enough food in my eyes. And it's very beige as well. There's not enough colour on that plate for me. You should get some eggs and protein down here as well.
Give me something that would be relatively easy for me to do tonight, but would do my body the world of good if I had it on a kind of regular basis.
Yeah, so one of my favourite meals and my family's favourite meals is like a teriyaki salmon. So if you, you know, create a marinade with some ginger, garlic, chili, sesame oil, soy and honey, that's your very simple marinade. Just coat it in your salmon, bang it in the oven for 10 minutes. And that's your teriyaki salmon, absolutely beautiful. And then we like to serve it with like air fryer, crispy potatoes, and like either roasted or steamed vegetables. So yeah, it's an absolute winner.
Wow. You honestly, I was going to thank you for coming on. I think I need a thank you for making me hungry again. My body's supposed to be a temple this week, instead of which I'm going to be going running off to the fridge straight away.
And we can confirm that Mark's teriyaki salmon is indeed delicious. One of our favourite things about bringing you the Official EFL podcast every week is attempting to get under the skin of the game and finding out how things really work. At the end of November, when there were no EFL games because of the World Cup and the FA Cup second round, we thought it would be a perfect opportunity to host a management special and dig deep into the soul of two men who've been there and done it. Step forward Sheffield Wednesday's Darren Moore and Tranmere Rovers' Mickey Mellon.
Are you in the technical area 10 minutes before the end of a game? And although you are concentrating on the game, a little part of you is thinking, right, I just need to be careful when I come off here, when I go in front of the press or go on the radio and thousands of people are listening, that I say that rather than that. Is it that kind of thought process?
Yeah, I tell you what else happens, and Dan will laugh. I guarantee Dan will laugh at this. So I, many years ago, when I was a younger manager, I used to hate that when you walked into the press room and you did your press conference and then you would sort of read back maybe some of what was getting said. And the first sort of sentence in the reporter's script of you was, a frustrated Mellon walks into the room. So when I go into the room now, I say to the press, what do I look like just to see that what you're going to say I'm look like? Is it am I angry? Am I confused? And then that projects to the people reading it that I was frustrated or I was angry. And then if you go in and you just try and be like monotone, they'll comment on what you look then as well. A disinterested looking Mellon walked into the room today. You just think, you can't, what's going on? Because that's the problem that you get all the time is you're getting, Darren's absolutely right, you're getting judged all the time. And how you look, how you perceive to look, what you say, how you say it, what tone you say it in, an angry Mickey Mellon or a frustrated or an animated, or they can say whatever they want, but is it fair? A lot of it, no.
Do you mind if I drill into one of the tougher side of this, which is losing your jobs? And you've both had what I would describe as a kind of rug pulled from your moment. Darren, you at West Brom, Mickey, you at Fleetwood. That moment when it comes, can we humanise it? Can we describe it, Mickey, as to what it actually feels like? Because for most people across society, for most supporters who might be listening to this, if they lost their job, it would be a major life event. let alone that it would have to be carried out in public forums. So can you take us into that moment, please, Mickey?
With some humour as well, even though it's a bit... So what happens is there's different ways that clubs would come to you and say to you that your time is up. Neat Fleetwood, I heard on the radio before it even came to me, which was disappointing, but that happened that way.
Wow. Sorry, I just want to be absolutely clear. You didn't have an inkling, or you had an inkling, but it got released before it had been officially done. Or you're saying...
Yeah, I heard before it was done. So somebody must have spoken, somebody's heard, and then it's gone that way. But these things happen. I was apologised to Leah, which is, well, no thing, because I was unemployed after that. Never mind. But anyway, it's a bit... So you're in total control. It's yours. The club's yours. Everything you're responsible for. And then in a blink of an eye, a flick of a switch, you're nothing. And then this is the humour part. And Darren, we definitely had this moment at West Brom. You get a knock on the door and you get asked for the car keys, the laptop and the charger. And you give these three things back and the door shuts and that's the end. The guy drives away in your car with your laptop and your charger. And he always asks for the charger, by the way. And away we go, and you see him disappearing, and with him disappearing out of your eye line, the football club goes as well, and you are no longer there anymore. And that's what happens. And I'm pretty sure the exact same thing would have happened to Darren Mill.
Well, I think we need, I mean, this is a serious subject. Can we just clarify, did they take the charger as well, Darren? Have you still got it in your desk drawer at home?
I mean, it's brilliant what Mickey said, but I mean, mine was, I had like a sort of a 3 month period, to sort of hand mine back in. So that was it really. But, you know, going off what, Mickey said, yeah, you can feel that. And I suppose for me, it was very, I felt different because at the time, I had not one inkling that it was going to happen to me because, obviously when you're sort of doing well as what we were doing at the time or deemed to be doing at the time, I think we was fourth in the championship and everything to play for, not only just fourth, but for the top two, for the automatic spots and sort of to be told after the game in the manner was incredible, really.
It can be brutal.
Yeah, to be told, I honestly had not one idea at all, really, because I was so looking forward to the game. We'd done well in the game. We'd come out the game. I think we draw the game in the end, but we're still fourth and still doing really, really well. So to be told that was a real shock at the time, really, because... And when I was told at the time, I thought it was a joke. I really thought it was a joke just at the time. But yeah, accepted it and moved on. And obviously we know what happened, like sort of out in the media with it. It was brought to the attention of it. But I understand that's football. And I suppose for me, I suppose it was, you know, wanting the club to go and do that next stage, but that next step was not in place. So I was a bit disappointed to think that, you know, that even though I'd moved on, the next person wasn't in place and there wasn't a real backup plan for that, really. So in the end, I wish that I would have just stayed and finished the job, but it wasn't to be. So you learn from it, you handle it. But I think the biggest thing for me was, you know, when you do come out of it, you question yourself, you look within yourself. And I think that the biggest thing was ticking a box in your own self-esteem to go, no, actually, I was all right. Everything was fine. And in order going forward, I'm going to continue along the same path. But what I will do is making sure that you're trying to get better at the process that you're working under. And I think that's been it, really. So it's being self-assured within that when these disappointments come, you're able to look within and try and gain strength and be stronger through it.
Another part of that, Clem, was the support you get from LMA is fantastic.
Yeah.
But the next morning, the LMA were brilliant. I get a phone call from Sam Allardyce, because you know I'm close with Big Sam, and he said, there you go, well done. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, welcome to management. That's you. You've done the full circle. Now go and get a job. And that's you done the full. And he was right, because that's the full circle. That's part of the learning. You've got to go and lick your wounds, reflect, and then work out when you're ready to go again. And then you do the full circle, and then you go to the interviews and all this, and go and get another job. And that's our world. That's how it works.
No further questions, my lord. Thanks for the insight, guys.
Great to see you. Dan, good luck, my man.
And you too, mate. Good to see you.
Good for your results. God bless you. See you later.
Yes, mate. And you too, pal. Take care, mate.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Two absolute gentlemen of the game and a privilege to listen to their own personal take on the ups and downs of football management. When Sean Dyche left Burnley earlier this year and the club were relegated from the Premier League, many wondered how they would cope with life in a very different division. Many of their star players left and the signs looked ominous, but the arrival of Vincent Kompany galvanised the squad and got them aiming for an instant return to the top flight, as midfielder Josh Brownhill explains. After major personnel changes, with Burnley slightly less fancied than Norwich City and Watford, however, 22 games in, Vincent Kompany's leaders stand 9 points clear of fourth place Norwich City and 10 of fifth placed Watford. Let's talk to midfielder Josh Brownhill. Hand on heart, did you think it would take longer, Josh, for you to gel with all that change going on?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you always hope that when, you know, coming down from the Premier League, your eyes are always like, oh, I want to get back to the Premier League, I want to get back to the Premier League. And then new manager comes in, you know, some players leaving out of contract, you hear of rumours of other players leaving, and you start thinking, you know, there's going to be a big change here and a big change of style of play and all of that. So, you sort of hope that you want to get back, but realistically, you know, it's going to take a while before you find, you know, you get your feet on the ground sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you found a consistency that the others haven't, because the two others I mentioned there have found decent form in little flutters, but then they go on a bit of a blip along the way. But you just seem to have been machine-like from the second you kicked off against Huddersfield Town in the opening game of the season.
Yeah, I think we've been well-drilled since, you know, the first day that the gaffer came in and what they told us. And, you know, they've put in a lot of work, you know, a lot of hours, not just on the training pitch, in meetings, and you're sort of going through everything and, you know, making sure that we know, you know, all our roles down to a T. And like I said, there's still a lot of improving to happen, which I'm sure come towards the end of the season, you'll see us in full force. And, you know, even now, obviously, we're in good form, but I still feel like there's another level in us. But yeah, I mean, I think consistency is key. I think we've got beat twice. We probably only look like maybe losing probably once against Sheffield United. Feel like when we played against Watford, we still had chances in the second half, more so to, you know, to take the game on and sort of get the win. But, you know, unfortunately we didn't. But, you know, I'm happy where we are so far. We look really strong. So hopefully the form can continue.
When you look at the people that left the club, I'm guessing you've got a few mates in there who you liked being with on a day-to-day basis, and all of a sudden they're heading off to Brentford or Everton or wherever they've gone off to.
Yeah, it's a sort of a sad thing to sort of see them leave after spending so much time with them, so many years. And like I was saying before, they deserve their move. They're really, you know, top quality Premier League players. And, you know, for Maxwell and Ben Mee has shown going to Brentford, he's done amazing. Tarkey, Everton with Dwight, and, you know, they're really, really good players, and, you know, they deserve to be there. Obviously, it's a little bit going because you sort of want the good core people to stay and give yourself a good chance. But like I say, I'm delighted for them to be in the Premier League, and for us, we're doing well, which makes it a little bit more easier for them for leaving.
Being honest, when you've got a bit of a Premier League legend, Vincent Kompany, coming in, even though he comes from the other side of Manchester, the one you started your career at, Are you a little bit nervous on that first day when you go into the sort of group meeting or the one-to-one and think, wow, where do I fit in here? It's Vincent Kompany I've got.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I played for United, I was a City fan and my family's a City fan.
Oh,
yeah,
so they're all right.
I mean, my oldest brother's a really big fan of Vinny anyway. So for me, it's exciting. You know, like I said, being a City fan and sort of the Premier League legend status that he's got and how well he's done in his career. So it was exciting. But still, yeah, when new manager comes in, you don't know where you stand. And for a while, I didn't know sort of where I sort of couldn't really read him. And, you know, with all the sessions that he was doing, you go home, you're thinking, is he having me? Is he not? You know, because obviously it's football, and football is one manager likes you and another person, you don't suit their system. I've come from playing one sort of way to a fully changed go to another. So, you know, you never knew where you were going to stand. And, you know, after a while, we had a little bit of a meeting and, you know, he was just explaining to me where he sees me affecting the game and, you know, sort of my role in the team. And, you know, he wanted to be a big member of the team. And, you know, since then I knew he was, you know, sort of happy with where I was at. And like I say, he's really good. He wants me to prove every single day. And it's something that is, like I say, when it's really exciting because, like I say, every day is like a learning day.
And we wish them good luck. Now, before we go, like myself, you'll no doubt have followed closely and enjoyed this very unusual Winter World Cup that culminated in that most extraordinary of finals between Argentina and France. One man who was out in Doha working on the television coverage was former Ipswich Town and Charlton Athletic captain Matt Holland, who represented the Republic of Ireland 20 years ago in Japan and South Korea. We've seen our fair share of high-pressure penalty shootouts in this World Cup, not least of which in the final itself. So what does it feel like when the unthinkable happens? Obviously, you scale the heights domestically as a player, but would playing a World Cup be effectively the moment, the thing you are most proud of when you were selected for the Ireland squad and then obviously played such a huge part?
I think it's the pinnacle, isn't it? I think growing up, you sort of watch cup finals and you want to be involved in that. And I always had a dream of lifting a trophy at Wembley, was able to do that, fortunately, with Ipswich in the playoffs, and we got promoted. I guess as a kid growing up, I envisioned it being an FA Cup rather than a playoff trophy, but it was still pretty special. And then I guess watching the World Cups, you know, my first memory was probably 82. And just watching the World Cup every 4 years, it's something special. Some of the great players that have played on that stage. And so to be able to play at that level is a dream. And then, of course, scoring in the first game against Cameroon, it was just something that, you know, you can't really explain how you feel. It just sort of is the best feeling you're ever going to have. So it's pretty special, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you literally, and it, I mean, we would have moved into the era, I'm suspecting, of more freedom of media, even back in 2002. Literally, do you go back to your hotel room and you find somewhere where that goal is and you just watch it a zillion, million times?
Not to be honest, no, not at that time. I mean, I've watched it plenty since, but you get the general reminder every year on this day, 2002, etc. But so I've watched it plenty since. But at the time, you've just
set the reminder in your phone. Do you have that piece of video in a strategic place? So when you have the 1 week in advance reminder to do something, and then 9 o'clock on the day of, it just automatically pops up.
No, I let people do that, Clem. I let people do that. I let others do that. It's great. It's a great reminder, and it's a great memory to have. But at the time, as I say, you're immersed in the competition, and all you're thinking about is the next one. So that one's forgotten, and then you're on to, well, our second game was Germany. So that was our thought process, really.
Yeah. In stark contrast, I have to ask you. You obviously did take a penalty as part of the round of 16. Defeat to Spain. Not quite the same as what Harry Kane went through on Saturday night in real time in play. But when you are standing there with time to think about it, and you know that the eyes and hearts of a nation are on you, I'm trying to imagine, as you stand there in that place, how you're processing it, what is going through you, what the little chatterbox on your shoulder is saying to you.
Well, I wasn't thinking about getting a pizza advert, and it didn't materialise afterwards. what was I thinking about? To be honest, I only took 8 penalties in my career, all in shootouts. I didn't take them in game. I scored 7 and missed 1, and that's the only one I missed. And it's the only one that I put my foot through and blasted. The other 7 I placed. We'd practiced them the day before. We'd done quite an extensive practice the day before. We didn't have a set 5 penalty takers. It was literally at the end of the game, Mick McCarthy saying who fancied one, who wanted to take one. I felt pretty confident. I'd had a good tournament and felt good in myself about taking one. But the day before, all the penalties I'd taken, I put my foot through, and I'd made my mind up that that's what I was going to do, regardless of you know how I felt at the time. I was just going to put my foot through it. And so knowing my time was coming, I was just thinking about getting a good contact, clean contact, and putting it down the middle, and did that, but got too much of it and maybe leant back slightly too much, hit the bar, and the rest is history. And it is the worst. It is absolutely the worst feeling you're ever going to have. So much so that afterwards, well, actually, so I got taken for a drugs test after the game as well. So it was myself.
Oh, my goodness.
So literally not even able to go back to the dressing room. Myself and Robbie were in the drugs testing room for a good couple of hours because it was a hot tournament and so very dehydrated, weren't able to go and provide a specimen. So that took ages. But the team stayed, waited for us, which was brilliant. They could easily have gone and we could have got a car back to the hotel, but we were all in it together. Got back to the hotel room, phoned home. My wife and kids had come out for the first 2 games, but then had gone home. So was in tears in the room to them, and put the phone down. And then my door went. There was a knock on the door, and it was Kevin Kilbanner, who'd missed one himself in the shootout. And he said, "Come on, we're going out." I said, "No." I said, "I can't think about going out now." He said, "No, we're definitely, come on, we're going out. The whole team are going out, where everyone's going. You've got to come." I said, "No." I said, I'm gutted. Anyway, he dragged me out, and I will ever forever be grateful for that, really, because easily I could have sat in that hotel room and been despondent, been down about it. And I was still despondent about it. The next morning, I'm still despondent about it now, but I'll be forever grateful for that camaraderie and that you know, real team ethic that Kevin showed by dragging me out the room.
That is it for 2022. A huge thanks to all of the guests who've joined us so far this season. We're already looking forward to talking to the biggest names from the Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two over the second half of the campaign. If you've enjoyed this week's special episode, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement, wishing you all a very happy new year, and we'll see you next week for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.